language is so people would think more about what they wanted. And so we're not using kind of these established labels of monogamy, polyamory, relationship anarchy, things like that. But if those are floating around in your head, which of course, you know, the idea of monogamy is floating around in everybody's head if they grew up in this culture at all, then one-to-one bonding will clearly trigger that. So it's okay if you have those associations, but we're not trying to say monogamy and one-to-one bonding are the same thing, because there's all these cultural, there's all this baggage around what does monogamy mean. And you might be strongly emotionally bonded to someone and be kind of emotionally monogamous in that way, but be sexually open to other people. So you might be a one-to-one bonder, but a one-to-many sexer.
Welcome to the Multiamory Podcast. I'm Jace.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Dedeker.
We believe in looking to the future of relationships, not maintaining the status quo of the past.
So whether you're monogamous, polyamorous, swinging, casually dating, or if you just do relationships differently, we see you and we're here for you.
On this episode of the Multiamory Podcast, we're excited to have Dr. Eli Sheff back on the show to talk about her research on polyamorous families and how to determine if polyamory or some variation of it might be a good fit for you. We're going to be talking about some exciting new research-based treats for all of you out there, including a new research-backed online quiz to help determine your comfort level with non-monogamy or monogamy, as well as a new super short, fact-filled book, Children in Polyamorous Families, that just was released recently. When I was putting this intro together, I did not even include a bio because I'm just like, yeah, everyone knows who Dr. Eli Sheff is. But for those of you who don't, Dr. Elizabeth, aka Eli Sheff, is a researcher, expert witness, coach, speaker, and educational consultant with a PhD in sociology and certification as a sexuality educator from the American Association of Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. Dr. Sheff specializes in gender and sexual minority families, consensual non-monogamy, and kink BDSM. She is the foremost academic expert on polyamorous families with children, and her 25-year polyamorous family study is the only longitudinal study of polyamorous families with children to date. So Eli, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be back chatting with you delightful folks.
Thank you.
Now, I will be surprised. You know, you still hold this title of having the only longitudinal study. Is there anyone else vying for the title? Are you having to be king of the mountain and protect that? Like, are there any up-and-comers who are also entering the field?
You're pushing
of
them off the mountain. No, right? Get out of here. No.
Not that I know of. Longitudinal research is really hard, and I kind of started doing it on accident, really. I mean, it just kind of happened to me. Although I have to say there is this really interesting poly babes research in Canada about people. They studied people who were pregnant and having children in polyamorous families.
Right. Oh, I remember.
Like poly babies, not just like hot poly babes.
Not the hot poly babes, but babes like B-A-B-E-S, but meaning actual babies born into polyamorous families. So
it's an acronym. It's Bearing and Birth Experiences Study.
That's cute.
Wow.
Dedeker's very good at doing this in the middle of an episode. She's like, let me look that up.
Wow.
I'm going to tell you things.
So I don't think it's longitudinal. Dedeker, does it say there?
I don't.
They say qualitative.
Okay.
So it's qualitative can be longitudinal. My qualitative research is longitudinal, but most people are like, this is a one strike.
I think this
thing is
just
so much easier to plan.
It seems like if it was longitudinal, they would want to brag about that. But
maybe it will turn in. It'll be accidentally longitudinal as well.
I sure hope so. Yeah. Follow those kids and see how they're doing. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. Yeah.
How fascinating.
We now for a couple of years have been planning our own research study as well. that we plan to be longitudinal, but the whole thing kind of got thrown off by COVID. So that's kind of been delayed
like
another year. But yeah, we're excited to do that. Not specifically studying polyamorous families, although that will be included in it. So hopefully we can join you.
What are you going to research? I'm interested.
It's probably like spoilers or something. I probably can't tell too much. But basically looking at things like resilience factors and kind of looking longitudinally at how certain traits or relationship styles or types of relationships contribute to their longevity over time, as well as looking at things like not just how long do they last, but how healthy are they? You know, how are the feelings about them as they ended? You know, kind of that whole thing, as well as just trying to get a sense of kind of who out there is polyamorous, you know, the never-ending question we all want answered.
Right.
The label usage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We are not the academic geniuses behind the study. We're pairing, we are joining forces with Dr. Ryan Witherspoon.
Wonderful. He's fantastic.
Someone who actually knows what they're doing. So
thank goodness.
Yeah. But again, that's been kind of put on the back burner because of COVID.
Yeah.
We're doing kind of a similar thing. The principal investigator is Dr. Justin Mogilski. And we've just finished our phase one and are ready to release an online survey that we've just finished up. So I think definitely these two things should cross-pollinate.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Oh, they should.
So we should put Justin and Ryan together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Okay. Well, Justin and Ryan are listening.
Absolutely.
a brain date. That's great.
We'll set him up on a blind brain date. Justin and Ryan.
And they can develop a brain man.
Yes.
A brain man as well.
Yeah, that's good.
I love it.
That's good.
So this is your third time. I was going to say this is your first time. It definitely isn't. This is your third time on the show. And the first, just wrote this down, the first time was episode 45 from November 2015, which is incredible. Because that was in our first year or a little bit after our first year.
The day we're recording this is the day that our 300th episode releases.
That's exciting. So, congratulations, you three, on all of your success.
Thank you for being there at the beginning.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And then we had you on, let's see, in 2018 for episode 171. And that was, did we record that when we were all in Tucson together? I'm trying to remember. Or we just talked about we're going to be doing this.
Yeah.
We just kicked back and had cocktails together.
I do remember that.
That was
fun.
Planning this. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So we have you on basically every 2.5 years or so. So you're a mainstay.
Fun.
For us.
Well, then I'll be back in 2.5 years from now,
exactly.
too.
Yep.
And maybe then we can talk about our cross-pollinated study that has happened inevitably.
I love that idea.
We'll see. Yeah.
Okay. We'll set that intention for the future. It'll be lovely. Okay.
Absolutely.
So for both of those episodes, you know, we had you on to talk about the subject matter that's in your wheelhouse, which is, you know, your findings on polyamorous families and kids raised in polyamorous families and stuff like that. And we probably will talk about that a little bit more today, but you have this new project called the Bonding Project.
What is it?
Which is super exciting.
Yes. Can you tell us about that, please?
Oh, yes. I'm really excited about it. It's this collaboration with some other colleagues. We've developed this app for phones. A test you can take. It takes, I'm going to estimate about 10 minutes. I know y'all took it. Did it take you about 10-ish minutes?
Super, yeah 10-ish 10 minutes, maybe 15
10
if you deliberate.
15.
If you really
okay,
sit there
if
and
you
think
yeah. hard. And it is kind of a thoughtful test. It asks you some questions you might not have necessarily thought of before. It sorts people at this stage of the test. We're sorting people into kind of four primary categories. People who prefer to bond one-to-one, one-to-many, many-to-many, or solo. And, these initial categories, obviously, we are going to, as time goes on and we develop more tests, we're going to become more fine-toothed in that. Like one-to-many, for instance, there's a whole bunch of different ways one person can have relationships with many people. So developing tests within that larger category is coming up for us next. But for now, I think people in consensually non-monogamous relationships already could certainly find this useful to think about it, especially if you haven't thought about solo before.
Hmm.
But I think the people who might really have their mind blown by it are people in monogamous relationships who've never really thought about anything else and are like, oh, wow, you could do that. And that sounds kind of good to me, actually. And holy cow, I look at how I tested on this. Who knew? Yeah, we're really excited about the test. It's been released and we just got all sorts of interesting results from our first. I think we hit a benchmark of like, I don't know, I don't do the numbers. I do the questions and the background, you know, like in order to develop the test, I read tons of literature on satisfaction, relationship satisfaction. Huh. Mostly in consensually non-monogamous relationships, actually, because research on consensual non-monogamy often compares to monogamous relationships. So right. I got some of that there already. And mm-hmm. it tends to look around at the different types of consensual non-monogamy within that. Mm. So I pulled out all these factors that contribute to satisfaction in these relationships, and then we wrote questions around them.
Hmm.
So that's one of the big differences in this test between like this and another really well-known test, the Myers-Briggs. While that's actually a useful and interesting test, there's no science behind it. Somebody just of made it up. Yeah, isn't that interesting? Gosh,
it's been a lie this whole time. I feel so cheated.
I mean, I don't know that it's a lie.
It never
though.
Says that it's based on scientific anything.
That's true.
It's just kind of like, have fun, take this test.
I just kind of projected. I was like, these people sound like they know what they're talking about. I'll take a test.
And I think, I mean, it wouldn't have stuck around this long as if it were completely useless. You know, true. It must resonate with people on some level. But this test, we felt like grounding it in research and kind of pairing with other academicians. For instance, Justin Mogilski is an academic partner with us, and he looked through this and would use some of the data we generate to understand his sample. And so we're hoping not only to help people figure out what kind of relationship style and bonding style works best for them, but also on the back end to have lots of research data from a wide diversity of people that to help us better understand what are people choosing and, you know, what's generating that, how many people would prefer one to many or many to many. You know, that'd be interesting. And how many people are really, really want one to one and that's their primary thing and they really want to stick with that.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's something worth mentioning to our listeners who are hearing this and wondering about the test is that, that it's not like, you know, it's not like a Cosmo quiz. That's like, which one of these animals are you? And that's your relationship style, but it's more of those four categories you mentioned. It gives you a rating of, you seem to be strong, like have a strong affinity for one-to-one, and maybe you also have a strong affinity for many-to-many or for solo or whatever, that it's not like you end up in one of the four, but it's kind of, you seem like you might be strong in this one or maybe curious about this one or probably not so much this one. And that's, I think that's worth pointing out to people, that I think also in a way kind of makes it more like the Myers-Briggs where there's four categories and you're on a scale in each one. But
yeah, agree to disagree type scale.
Right, yeah. Right.
Thank you so much for saying that, Jace. Actually, we rate in each of those different four relationship categories, we rate people as either comfortable, curious, cautious, or challenged.
Okay. That's interesting because I didn't get the cautious or challenged on any of them.
You didn't get any of them. Really interesting.
Or no, maybe
no,
I did.
I think... We're going to, in the bonus episode, we're going to talk more about our specific results and stuff like that. But yeah, I guess I wanted to point out, you know, I think that it's clear for anyone who's been engaged or in touch with the non-monogamous community for some time, there's always people who are just like, I don't know if this is right for me. It seems like part of this could be appealing, but I also could see myself being okay with monogamy. Like, I don't know. Like, how do I determine that? And, you know, there are some people who've put out some resources, you know, some questions to ask yourself, some scenarios to think about. You know, I think that Kathy Labriola, in one of her workbooks, you know, she also did kind of a little quiz that was kind of just seeing where on the scale between non-monogamy and monogamy maybe you fit, or are you more of like a relationship chameleon or things like that. But what I do appreciate is that with the results of the bonding project, it's less of this, here's where you fall on a scale. And it is almost a little bit more like a grid. And I'm curious, you know, I think that a lot of people would think that it is this spectrum between non-monogamy and monogamy, but I'm curious to hear a little bit more explanation of these kind of four different categories of the one-to-one, one-to-many, many-to-many, and solo. Because even when I first took the quiz, I was like, I guess I can kind of guess what these might mean, but I can't make any assumptions. So can you like lay that out for our listeners a little bit?
Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons we used this somewhat vague but also specialized language is so people would think more about what they wanted. And so we're not using kind of these established labels of monogamy, polyamory, relationship anarchy, things like that. But if those are floating around in your head, which of course, you know, the idea of monogamy is floating around in everybody's head if they grew up in this culture at all, then one-to-one bonding will clearly trigger that. So it's okay if you have those associations, but we're not trying to say monogamy and one-to-one bonding are the same thing, because there's all these cultural, there's all this baggage around what does monogamy mean. And you might be strongly emotionally bonded to someone and be kind of emotionally monogamous in that way, but be sexually open to other people. So you might be a one-to-one bonder, but a one-to-many sexer. You know,
so you don't have the sexer project yet.
Right. yes. But so that person, you know, would probably fall at the intersection of one-to-one and one-to-many. And, you know, probably want to talk to their partner or partners about, hey, look, I'm kind of straddling these two categories here. How does this work for you? What kind of bonder are you? So one-to-one is wanting one other person and really being like, this is your home base. You know, you really kind of want to spend most of your time with that person. And you can spend time with other people, but you prefer for that person to be with you there, you know, even when you're hanging out with other people. And sometimes you don't want to hang out with other people. You just want to be with that person in your kind of loving nest is one-to-one. So without the judgment of, oh, and that, you know, that some kind of judgment sometimes comes from polyamorous communities of monogamy is kind of about ownership or something. You know, that's a lot of cultural, maybe it is for some people, but for some other people, it's really, they bond to one other person and that's their primary, you know, like, that's where their heart is. One to many can bond with multiple people. And sometimes those bonds are different. Sometimes those people are connected to, sometimes not. One to many is probably the broadest category. It basically covers if one person has the ability and or desire to be emotionally and or romantically or sexually or whatever involved with more than one person at the same time, they can bond to more than one. Many to many, if you're familiar with the idea of polyfidelity, where there's a group that it's the not the individuals within the group or the dyadic relationships in the group, but it's the group itself that you want to be part of, that polycule or that collective. And that's some of our early research, or our early findings are showing that a lot of people are either cautious or curious about that, but hardly anyone is like, yeah, I'm mostly many to many, you know, like many to many. I think it's a concept a lot of people don't have, and it's perhaps hard to maintain. It's more complicated than one to many. One to many is you're kind of doing your own thing and you have multiple partners. Many to many is you value the group.
Right.
And some people love that, and that's really important. And other people are like, oh no, get that off of me. That's claustrophobic. That's way too much. And some of those solo people either don't want a primary relationship, don't want to have sex, don't want to have a romantic relationship, have multiple partners, and they don't really want to, you know, elevate them on different wavelengths, or they sometimes have their most significant relationship is with someone who's not a romantic partner. So a single parent who prioritizes their children, or someone taking care of an elder parent or someone who's ill, or just a best friend, you know, is your most stable person, and relation, like romance comes second to that. So we're finding a lot of interest in solo bonding, and especially among young people. The 18 to 28, I think, range had, like, I think almost half of them identifying as solo bonders. And these are early days still. We're just getting numbers in.
Right.
But
it'll be interesting to see how that grows over time as the reach of the study gets larger as well, and to kind of see some different demographic information. That's really interesting.
I'm really
I'm
just curious about the research that you did and kind of how you developed all of this. Can you go into that a little bit? And like, was there preemptive research and now also research that's happening on the back end, or what, how did that all occur?
Well, first I read other people's research, people who's published research, like for instance, Dr. Terry Conley, C-O-N-L-E-Y, her research was key in this. She's done a lot of work on relationship satisfaction in polyamorous and consensually non-monogamous relationships. So she and Dr. Amy Moores and Dr. Heath Schekinger and Ryan Witherspoon, who you mentioned already, you know, all sorts of people have looked at this, like what makes these relationships, if people are satisfied in them, what kinds of characteristics in, you know, include that. So for instance, one of them, one of these characteristics is novelty seeking. If people not only can kind of tolerate, but even actively celebrate new things, they tend to be more comfortable in a polyamorous relationship. Whereas some people, novelty feels threatening. Like they much prefer to have familiarity, and comfort and routine is what works in their life. And like surprises are not fun. Whereas for, if you're a novelty seeking person, you're like, yeah, surprise me. I love surprises, you know? Yeah. So things like that, identifying those elements. And so first we wrote, oh my goodness, I think the first test I wrote had like 100 questions or something total. Outlandish. It was huge.
Yeah.
And so the four of us on the team, we would take it and we would be like, okay, this question, we can't even understand what it means now after we've written it. We don't know I don't know what that means. Let's just get rid of that one. These three questions basically all ask the same thing. So we'll choose the best one of those. You know, for months and months, we added and subtracted and changed until we had this kind of prototype that we tried on all sorts of people. We tried on my elder child and their polycule and got some great feedback from them. We tried on our friends. We tried on, you know, just kind of people in our immediate social circle and got feedback on that. And then we really took that feedback to heart and revamped the whole thing and cut it way down.
Yeah, I'm trying to, is it a 50 question? No, it's not even that not long, even. Is it?
It's like 20, right?
It's freakishly brief for what it does.
Yeah.
I know, I was going to say, from a researcher perspective, I imagine that would be the most challenging part is getting it to actually be
and
brief.
Slicing, yeah.
Yeah.
And for every question to really mean something. You know, we got rid of all the fluff questions that were kind of interesting to ask, but didn't really directly contribute to deciding, you know, which of these, like, what's your comfort level?
Yeah.
And thank goodness for our quantitative brainiacs on the team, because on the back end, they've built all of this stuff I don't understand that takes those answers and does something magic to them, and they come out in understandable formats that actually, from the feedback we've gotten so far, are pretty accurate. And I'd be interested to hear what you all think of your feedback when the time comes.
Yeah, yes, definitely. We have also not shared our results with each other very much yet. So in the bonus, that'll be fun for us to also talk to each other about our results as well as talking to you about it. So yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah. Can you give our listeners just a little sampling of, you know, what kind of questions are they going to be facing? You know, like, are you going to sit me down and make me detail my entire relationship history and my failed attempts at monogamy and stuff like that? You know, like how are you, you know, once you distilled to all your like golden essential questions, what was left over?
Well, there's a range of ways to answer each question, from, oh yeah, totally comfortable with that, to kind of comfortable but have some reservations, to don't really have a lot either way, to not super comfortable but not horribly uncomfortable, to like really uncomfortable with that. So because we realized when we were kind of pilot testing it, that just having an agree or disagree, you know, like, are you comfortable sharing your partner with other partners is one of the questions we ask. You know, I think for a lot of people, the answer is that depends.
Yeah.
What's my relationship with my partner? Who am I sharing this person with? Am I there? Do I know about it? Have we talked about it beforehand? Do I like this person? Am I actively involved? Do I not want to be involved? You know, like, it depends on so much. So if you think about kind of overall, are you comfortable sharing your partner with other partners? For some people who are deeply, deeply polyamorous, and that's an orientation for them, they're probably going to say yes, full on yes. And, you know, I'm not, no hesitation about that. For someone who is deeply, deeply monogamous, they're probably going to say, no, it doesn't depend. There's no question in my mind. Absolutely not. But for the other people, when they think about overarchingly, I lean towards being accepting with some reservations. Or I lean towards probably not with some exceptions.
It helps to have that more nuance, more so than just the classic totally disagree, kind of disagree, neutral, agree, you know, that it helps to have it written out in that way. Because if there's definitely anything that I've learned in like meeting so many different non-monogamous people, is there's a lot of flavors and colors of nuance of the rainbow of how people go about this and what people are actually comfortable with.
Absolutely. At first, actually, in the development of the test, we had an it depends thing that people could click on, and it would be a drop-down menu. And that drop-down menu got so crazy long, and it still didn't cover everything.
Yeah,
we were like, we can't cover everything that it depends. We've got to come up with like, yes, no, it depends. You know, we are like, so you're scrolling and scrolling and scrolling still. It's, oh, it would depend on that. I see. You know, we're like, we just can't figure every, it depends out.
Yeah.
Right.
And Jason Dedeker, I'm not sure how you two took the test, but I took it very much in the context of the relationship that I'm currently in, like with that in mind, as opposed to just like if I was 100% single or whatever. And so that, I think, colored my results for sure. Whereas I'm not sure how that might be different for someone who was, you know, practicing solo polyamory, for instance, or relationship anarchist or hierarchical polyamory or totally monogamous, stuff like that. So that's
interesting. Or someone who's single and is like,
exactly.
I don't know. Do I want a relationship? If I do, what kind might I want?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of interesting.
You know, there's Emily, I'd be really interested if you would take it again and think not of your current relationship, but like relationships in general and compare those two and see if they're different at all would be super interesting.
Yeah. I do wonder how that would be. And we will absolutely talk about it more in the bonus episode. But yeah. But
maybe we need to make some time for you to really quickly retake Emily, just to...
Well, yeah.
Because that's super fascinating. It's science, Emily. It's science.
No, I know. Yeah.
There's how the results change depending on what your mindset is.
That's true. Yeah. I took it in bed yesterday and I was like, I think I'm not quite sure what I should be doing here. So yeah, just kind of trying to figure that out.
I appreciated you pointed out that on the back end, as you're seeing people responding, you know, this kind of interesting phenomenon of like a lot of people who are maybe curious or cautious about many to many, not a lot of people who are super, super gung ho. And I think that makes sense when I think about Americans specifically. Like, I think we're pretty well socialized to be suspicious of anything relatively collectivist. And I think that makes sense that that's how
individuals
that would come out in the wash.
Damn it.
We are individuals. I'm wondering, other than that, any other surprising things that you found so far?
Boy, you know, I just got these graphics that I can I share my screen? Can we look at them and talk about them?
Oh, okay. So Eli is sharing her screen with us and we're looking at these results and there's some really amazing colorful pie charts. So we have one pie chart that's bonders by orientation. And it's broken down into like asexual, bisexual, bisexual and queer, gay, heterosexual and queer. And then the other one was what bonders by like relationship orientation as well.
Let's scooch over.
Bonders by age.
Wow.
Bonders by orientation.
So this is just
looks
of
we're
everyone
heavy
who's...
on the heterosexuals.
Yeah.
But ironically, heavy. Only 43% heterosexual, whereas in average society, it's at least 90% heterosexual. So even that's though we've got almost half hetero.
That is what they tell us.
That's what they say, but maybe people are being more honest.
So 43% heterosexual, and then everyone else falls under like lesbian, pansexual, queer, panromantic, asexual, bisexual, gay, all those things. Wow, fascinating.
Let's see. Okay, bonders by age. So it looks like we have the majority.
No one above 60.
No one above 60 yet, and that might have been a function of who we knew, you know, and who we asked
see, in
to
the
pilot
initial round.
Test.
Yeah, that makes
yes.
sense.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And also because people over 60 are less likely, I think, to want to use an app specifically for relationships. Like this is more for the millennials and the Zoomers, I would say, than the
sure,
boomers.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Aren't we all Zoomers now?
I'm Gen X, actually.
Yeah.
The lost generation of we're just a nothing.
Well, but now we're all honorary Zoomers.
Right.
Yes.
We spend all day on
Everyone's an honorary Zoomer these days.
It's true. Yeah. It's a good point.
So do you have any data breakdown by bonding style?
Let's
so far
see. This is, okay, so by heterosexuality, by age.
Oh, wow.
Still age.
I see.
Breaks down very back. Granular here, where it's it's not only showing the amount of people who are cautious, challenged, curious, or whatever the different styles, but also broken down by their orientation and things like that. That's fascinating.
That's really cool.
Yeah, are you, I mean, I feel super lucky that we're getting access to this, like, secret behind the scenes charts and data. Are you intending to, at some point, release any of this data for public consumption for all of us curious cats out there?
You know, definitely. That's one of the reasons that we're already partnering with other academicians, because I do not do statistics at all. I can't deal with statistics. And so having other people take these and really, you know, seriously analyze them and say, what does this mean? I'm great on the incoming end of how do we construct this and making sure that it's accurately measuring what we're trying to measure, but then deciding what those statistical results mean. So we're pairing up with other people who can do that for us.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. And what's kind of your vision for the future of where this test may go or what it may develop into?
Well, for one thing, we're going to move into not only being able to compare. Right now, I think we can compare two people's results. But our next phase would be being able to compare the results of a polycule, like taking five people's results and saying, you know, this is where you're going to be strong. This is where you have some differing bonding styles that you might have some issues here. So for that, we would want to develop a range of other tests that can differentiate, like, for instance, among solo bonding. There are so many different ways to do that, and figuring out, you know, people who are curious or comfortable with solo bonding, what exactly the different ways they could do that. And then if they're part of a polycule, how does that interact if somebody else is more emphasizing like many to many bonding? Mm-hmm. That polycule, you might say, okay, we're going to have some issues around the collective versus the group.
Right.
It's not that how do
we balance it? Yeah.
No, that makes so much sense. And I could see that being so helpful because, you know, you were mentioning that I think a lot of the real world instances that we see of people doing this many to many bonding, where the emphasis is on the collective, it's on the cule and how it functions as a group, that often in real life, it does become difficult for people to maintain sometimes. And sometimes they can be not very stable. And the way that I've always thought about it is that it's like whenever, if you have like a polycule of, let's say, six, and we're all trying to make this collective and like cohabit and like make a little commune, there's always going to be someone in that group who's like the least excited about the collective than anybody else. Yeah. That's how I always thought about it. But I think this makes sense that if you could identify, obviously not from a place of like judgment or condemnation or someone being bad or someone being good, but just this like, oh, this person just really thrives better with solo bonding rather than many to many, or
then
this
you
person
shun
is
them and get them out of it.
We identify no, but maybe we identify, okay, on the big piece of property that we're buying to create a commune, we'll make sure that you get your own little house. Yeah, maybe it's that. I mean, maybe that's a silly example, or maybe that's an on the nose example. I don't know. It kind of depends on people's situations. But I think that really makes sense as far as like practical applications of, instead of it being this assumption of like, okay, everyone's in the collective and everyone has to be equally excited about it or else this is not going to work, that we can really identify these individual variations and then hopefully build something out of that that's more flexible and kind of more speaks to everybody's strengths and areas of most comfort.
Especially if you do it early in the relationship to help figure out before you've made these hard and fast agreements, and then it's like, oh, you're in trouble, you're breaking the agreement. I mean, sometimes people don't know what they want, or they haven't even thought it through really to even think, what are my options? And hopefully that's one of the things that this test can help, is people start to consider, oh, I didn't even know you could do it that way. And now that you ask me that question, I wow, I'm surprised to think that I might really consider that. And so at least help people start conversations about what kind of boundaries and what kind of bonding do they want without kind of just stumbling blindly forward in a way and kind of assuming everybody either has the same bonding style or one is better and really we should make sure everybody jumps onto that one.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
One of the big motivations for this actually was also developing a tool that counselors and therapists could use to help their clients. We're not calling it a diagnostic tool specifically because that's a whole different threshold of research kind of, and we're not trying to diagnose,
right,
you know, anything. But it's certainly the way that therapists consider, you know, recommend people take the Myers-Briggs to figure themselves out.
Hmm.
This same kind of thing, that people could decide what kind of bonding style they want and help talk to their partner. And if you can compare results, see where, again, no one being at fault, but just differing personality styles or expectations or bonding styles could expose, you know, like, oh, here's a difference here. How do we handle that?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm so excited to just see what results come out of this, like what all of you on the back end see after this has been out there for months, years, you know, even longer. Like, it's going to be super fascinating.
When those pie charts become more definitive.
Yeah.
All of those many, many pie charts. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that'd be very exciting too, that as those results come in, if you're able to share some of those things on the Bonding Project website so that people can kind of see that as it comes in, because that's definitely a lot of really interesting, very cool data that I know a lot of our listeners will be excited to, mm-hmm. they're like, I want to know, I want to see it.
So. Yeah. And yeah, kind of see where they fit in the bigger picture and
right,
everything.
Right.
That's cool. That's a, yeah.
Yeah. So all y'all listening out there are probably like, I want to take this too. I want to find out. So if you just go to bondingproject.com, there's not only the test itself, but also ways to sign up for their newsletter and FAQ, all kinds of other information so that you can kind of keep up to date with what is happening with the Bonding Project. So again, just go to bondingproject.com. It'll work in your regular browser, on your mobile browser, wherever. And yeah, we would definitely be really curious to hear from all y'all what kind of results you got.
So next, we want to talk about the new book, Children in Polyamorous Families. But before we get to that, we're going to take a quick break to talk about how you can support this show, help keep these coming to everyone out there for free, and we will see you after that.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
For a long time now, we've been fans of AdamandEve.com for getting sex toys or lingerie or accessories, things like that. It's just a fantastic resource with a huge selection. And now, not only do we have a fantastic offer, but we also have a promo code that will work on AdamMale.com and EvesToys.com, which are their sites specifically for LGBTQ audiences. And our code is fantastic. It's 50% off of almost any item in the store and free discreet shipping when you use our code MULTI.
Yes, we love AdamandEve.com and have for years. They are our oldest and longest sponsor, and they just keep on giving great gifts to us and to our listeners. You can bring more pleasure and satisfaction into your bedroom by going to adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com and select any one item. It can be, you know, an adventurous new toy or anything you desire, something fun, something sexy, whatever sounds good.
So just enter offer code MULTI at checkout and you'll get 50% off almost any item plus free shipping. That's MULTI, M-U-L-T-I, at adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com. This is an exclusive offer that is specific to this podcast, and it's better than any offer that is currently available on their site. So again, use code MULTI to get you not just the 50% discount, but also the 100% free shipping. Code M-U-L-T-I.
So we're going to start talking about this new book, Children in Polyamorous Families. And I want to start by saying that I think the last time we had you on the show, it might have been after that, but we talked about your book, When Someone You Love is Polyamorous, that is a similar kind of short summary of key pieces of information, answers to a lot of those common questions from people who are either brand new to the concept of polyamory or, you know, when someone you love is polyamorous, like your son or daughter or your uncle or whoever comes out to you as being polyamorous, that the book is sort of a resource that instead of having to ask them all those questions, or, you know, maybe your uncle, it's like, here, actually just read this book before you ask me the questions, because then you'll at least have a foundation. That this book is, and that book talks a little bit about children, but this one is kind of the version of that that's specifically about families and children. Just kind of brief overview of what the research shows, what the facts are, what the myths are, things like that. And I love that we have another book like this. I think that's incredibly helpful. So is that what led to this getting created, and what's that been like?
I really appreciate you characterizing it that way, Jace. That's exactly what I meant it to be.
Great.
I would say that when I'm speaking on polyamory, I get a lot of the same questions about kids. And so I kind of took note of those and answered them all in short book format. So if people are trying to explain to their mother-in-law or the school counselor or their lawyer or something, and I've been working on the longer book, the much more academic version, for a long time now, and I'm still working on it.
Wait, so hold on, though, because you published The Polyamorous Next Door a few years ago. You're working on another academic, longer book version as well,
with
updated findings, or
the follow-up to that. So The Polyamorous Next Door was on both the adults and the kids, and I'm breaking up the follow-up into the academic book, Growing Up in Polyamorous Families, will be on the kids, and that's still coming. It's a longer book, it's much more academic, and I am trying hard to diversify my sample. I'm going back into another round of interviews, trying to find people of color who've grown up in non-monogamous households, any kind of BIPOC folks who want to talk to me about it. And while they wouldn't have been in the original sample, at least having a more diverse idea of different families, I'm trying. So that's kind of stalled that book out a little bit, trying to diversify that. And then the book after that would be The Persistent Polyamorists: Aging in Long-Term Polyamorous Relationships.
I like that. So the persistent
polyamorous. I'm just like, we are stubborn, aren't we?
Well, and it's the people who, they keep doing it. They're you know, maybe they started in, for some of these folks, started in their teens or 20s. And we're talking like, you know, early in the 70s, in the 60s, some of these folks, and they're still polyamorous, and they've had, you know, they're dealing with aging issues. Right. And how is that in a long-term polyamorous setting? First of all, how do you maintain a long-term relationship? And second of all, how does it deal with aging and disability and, you know, grandchildren, stuff like that.
Right. So, there's definitely a gap. I think there's a gap in the, I don't want to say necessarily in the market, but it's kind of like there's almost like this gap in like the publicly available like information and resources regarding that, especially from a research background as well.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to read those books. So, but right now we're talking about this book, which is Children
the Kids' Book. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And so this book is, I was actually surprised at first by how short it was. But then when I realized it's like, that's actually perfect because it's that book for, like you said, the school counselor or your mother-in-law or someone who has some concerns, and that it can kind of add a little bit of credence to it, I think, having it come from a book and not just, oh, let me tell you what I think about these things. And so I think that's a huge benefit, and I think will be really useful to people in those sorts of specific use cases, especially of just like, I want to get some information to someone. I don't want to ask them to read The Polyamorists next door and commit to reading, you know, several hundred pages of a book. But I do want them to get that information. And so I think this is super cool. So of the stuff that's in it, they kind of cover some major categories. And one that jumped out to me because we saw you speak about this in Arizona a couple years ago, which is the age-dependent experiences of children. And I was just curious if you could give our listeners sort of the brief rundown of that, because I think that's just such an interesting part of the research that I hadn't really heard other people talk about.
Absolutely. So small children are not that aware of the broader world. They don't understand sex, and they take their family for granted. So little kids, like under 5, often don't understand what polyamory means. They don't know that they're in a polyamorous family. They just take their family for granted. That's the way family is. Once they start going to elementary school, they start realizing, oh, other families are different. And it's so funny that multiple families, polyamorous families, have had the experience of their child coming home from a play date with another family and with this big news of they only have one parent or they only have two parents. Like, can you believe that? That sounds so hard. How do they even do that? That poor kid, you know? And it, so for the children, it doesn't translate as a deficit of, oh my God, we're so weird, we have all these extra people. Not a deficit on their part, but more a deficit on the peers' part that they don't get as much attention. The kind of, oh, we're weird feeling doesn't start to leak in until the kid is a tween. And the tween is like 9 to 11 or so in there. And then they're becoming more aware of differences in other people's families. They're starting to, you know, they're not like fully pubescent yet, but they're coming on towards puberty. So they're starting to be not such a little kid anymore. And they're just connecting things. They're understanding things in a different way. So that by the time they hit their teens and they're in puberty, they're like, oh, you mean that kind of friend? You know, they're totally zoning in on their family is different from other people's families. You know, this relationship that they had seemed like, who cares? You know, so mom kisses this person, whatever. You know, they hit 13 and they're like, you're kissing? Oh my God! You know, like, gross! Parents are gross! Sex is gross! Parent sex is the worst! You know? And then by the time they're older teens, they're not as concerned about their family. They're moving away. You know, they're much more concerned about what they're doing and who their friends are and what's happening in their life, and much less like obsessing about what their parents are doing. They don't care. And then by the time they're young adults, it makes them kind of a rock star to have come from a non-monogamous family. Like if it's relevant to the conversation, then they bring it up. Oh, yeah, I grew up in a polyamorous family. Their friends are like, wow, that's so cool. Do tell. Like, what's that like? You know?
Right.
So it's just because developmentally, humans are incredibly different at those early stages. Like, there's a huge difference between a 4-year-old and a 9-year-old, an enormous difference.
Yeah.
And their understanding of family life in general. So it makes just a lot of sense that they would understand polyamory differently as well.
I finally had a kind of an in-person experience of this with my niece and nephew for the first time, who in the past couple of years, both have entered that tween stage. And of course, when they were much younger, you know, I would bring multiple partners around them. Basically, ever since I was out, like to my sister's family, you know, I would bring multiple partners around to the kids. And this last summer, when Jace and I were hanging out with them, it was the first time that like they connected the dots ever. And I was so surprised. I mean, hearing this now, I'm like, okay, that makes sense from a developmental perspective that they just didn't have the interest or motivation to connect the dots. But it was literally the first time that they were both were suddenly like, wait, do you have two boyfriends? Yeah. You have two boyfriends. Why do you have two boyfriends?
this is not the first time this has happened.
I was just like, yeah, this has been going on for years, but it was like the first time that they were suddenly like, our auntie is different in this way and we're curious about it. And it wasn't a bad experience necessarily, but it was just kind of funny that it was like, wow, it took you this many years to get to that point.
Well, small children, they're much more concerned, like, is Jace fun to play with? Will he bring us ice cream? You know, they don't care. Yeah. Is Jace having sex with Auntie Dedeker? They don't even know what sex is. You know, like, is Jace a source of Legos? That's much more important for little kids.
Yeah, they've mostly been obsessed with Jace being a source of, like, playing video games together. That's been the most important part. So I'm definitely curious to see how that conversation is going to evolve with them as they get older, because I've kind of been leaving it up to their mom of like, I mean, I'll be honest with you, but I'm mostly going to leave it up to your mom to handle like the hard questions, you know, if she wants. And so, yeah, I don't know. I'll be curious to see as they get older and kind of go through these different developmental stages, how that's going to go.
Just throw the podcast at them.
Oh, I'm not ready for that yet. That's a little too much. That's a little too much information about Auntie to throw at them quite yet.
The rest of the world gets
quite
to
yet.
Yeah. This is a much later chapter, but I think that probably it's like a good one, especially if people out there are really worried about what polyamory may do to a kid, if that's like what they have in their head. So you have a big chapter chapter on fear of damage to children. So can you talk about that a little bit?
I think a lot of people just kind of off the cuff assume that something's weird with polyamory, something's wrong with it, it must be damaging to the children, without really any basis in fact, but just a knee-jerk reaction of, oh, this can't be good for kids. And that doesn't appear to be the case in these families. And even in some of the families where there was emotional pain, there were painful divorces, even in those families, the kids overall feel like they learned a lot about communication and emotional resilience and the ability to, you know, kind of fledge themselves, leave home, and reestablish networks of emotional intimacy wherever they go. That's a really important life skill that they learn from polyamorous relationships. So I would say that polyamorous families don't have any disadvantages that other families don't experience. You know, their polyamorous families do have disadvantages, absolutely. But divorced families have partners that leave. Families that, you know, widowed families have partners that leave. Gay and lesbian families face stigma. Large families face household crowding. You know, anything you can think of that goes wrong in a polyamorous family also goes wrong in other families. They're family problems. And it turns out that when you have multiple adults with more resources to deal with these problems, that actually goes a long way towards ameliorating the negative effects of these common family problems. Like, the blow is a lot lighter because it's distributed among more parents so they can get more sleep, so the kids get better care. Things like that. So when there is a death in the family, for instance, there's more people to provide the support. And it's not, I'm not saying it's not a blow to lose someone, you know, an important family member, you still feel it. But especially like if it was one spouse and you have three other spice left, mm-hmm. you're not as lonely. Or one parent and you have multiple parents other left, you're not as destitute emotionally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just to give our listeners a little bit of a rundown, you know, this really great condensed book, you know, covers not only the stuff we've been talking about here, but also talking about the advantages, the disadvantages, strategies. You really clearly lay out, like, here are some of the common, like, coping strategies that polyamorous families take to be able to just, you know, live as a non-monogamous family in a very monogamous world. We get a lot of people who reach out to us occasionally, you know, parents specifically asking for specific resources because it's not a topic we cover a lot on this show because none of us are parents. And, you know, we all feel like we're often out of our depth. But if you're listening to this, I highly recommend starting with Eli Sheff's this short version of the book. You know, if you just have questions, if you're thinking about opening up your relationship and you're a parent, or if you're already in a non-monogamous relationship and have questions, this seems like a great place to start. And then if you want more information, you know, you can always go on to reading The Polyamorous Next Door and things like that, as well as it being a great resource to give to someone in your life who does have a lot of questions and you don't have the time to answer all those questions because you're trying to raise a kid. So Eli, we would love to hear from you. Where's it specifically that people can go to find more of you and more of your work?
You can check out my website is a good place for that, elisabethsheff.com, ElisabethSheff.com. You can also find me on Psychology Today. My blogs there are free. I blog under The Polyamorous Next Door there.
We've used a couple. I know that I personally have used a couple in our episodes. A couple of your blogs.
Yeah,
awesome.
Very helpful. So thank you.
Glad to hear that.
And then also to remind our listeners, if you want to check out the Bonding Project quiz, you can just go to bondingproject.com. No the. Just bondingproject.com. You can take the quiz there and you can share your results with other people. In our bonus episode, which we're going to go do right now, we are going to talk about our own results that we got on that quiz and discuss those with Dr. Sheff a little bit. We would also love to hear from you on our Instagram story. We want to know your bonding style you came up with on this quiz. So if you want to share that online, you can do that on our Instagram. If you also just want to discuss this in general, the best place to share your thoughts with other listeners is on this episode's discussion thread in our private Facebook group or Discord chat. You can get access to these groups and join our exclusive community by going to patreon.com/multiamory. In addition, you can share with us publicly on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can also email us at info@multiamory.com. Multiamory is created and produced by Dedeker Winston, Emily Matlack, and me, Jace Lindgren. Our episodes are edited by Mauricio Balvanera. Our social media wizard is Will McMillan. Our production assistants are Rachel Schenowork and Carson Collins. Our theme song is Forms I Know I Did by Josh and Anand from the Fractal Cave EP. The full transcript is available on this episode's page on multiamory.com.